The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the pancreas is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
Next topic of discussion is disease of the pancreas. And just like with the colon, acute and chronic pancreatitis is the lion's share of disease of the pancreas, but I will mention a couple of other things that are good to know for the boards. Again, things you don't see very often, but things that you should be aware of. Pancreatitis, as you know, can be acute or chronic. There's a certain number of folks that don't survive either one, but by and large, people get better with time and rest. You can see there that chronically, alcohol is the biggest player in chronic pancreatitis, and gallstones and alcohol and acute pancreatitis are the biggest cause. There's a whole list of other type of things, and we'll cover some of them that may cause pancreatitis, things like hypertriglyceridemia and certain drugs. Just a little bit about how this happens. This is a diagram of the acinar cell and how it puts together enzymes that are secreted by the pancreas. There's a process there. You can see the reticuloendoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi apparatus that eventually extrude the enzymes into the lumen. And what happens is that process is activated intraluminally rather than extraluminally whenever pancreatitis occurs. We don't quite understand yet why that happens. What is it, a pressure phenomenon? Is there a toxin of some sort? Nobody's ever been able to figure that out, I don't think. But regardless of the cause of pancreatitis, we do know that enzymes are activated within the acinar cell rather than the lumen of the pancreas. And that's, you get a process then called autodigestion, where the pancreas basically eats itself alive and can again result in death. Here's some other etiologies besides alcohol and gallstones, autoimmune disease. I think I've got a slide or two here on autoimmune pancreatitis. Drug-induced, iatrogenic, happens with a surgical misadventure on occasion or a ERCP gone wrong. Inflammatory bowel disease related. Occasionally, I think it was 3 years ago, we had a patient admitted to University Hospital twice with pancreatitis and couldn't figure out why. And there was fortunately somebody on the GI team on the second hospitalization asked if he'd ever had a colonoscopy, and he had not. And it was discovered that he had a mild case of ulcerative colitis as a cause of his pancreatitis. Infections of various sorts, inherited pancreatic disease, metabolic problems, I mentioned triglycerides, neoplastic processes, structural, toxic, traumatic, and vascular diseases can all be a cause of pancreatitis. This is an annular pancreas. This is a congenital abnormality. It may not manifest until adulthood, but what you see there is that the head of the pancreas is wrapped around the duodenum, and that shouldn't be. They should be contiguous. They should be next to each other, but the head of the pancreas should not be wrapped around the duodenum. And the result of that can be pancreatitis. There's some controversy about that. The problem with this problem is you don't get enough numbers, because it's rare, to be able to do any kind of a study to determine much more about it than we already know. Sphincter of Oddi dysfunction. Ever since Hogan and Janine described this in 1990, it has undergone an evolution. There used to be three different types. Now there's basically just one, and it has to do with spasm of the sphincter of Oddi. It's a difficult diagnosis to nail down. The treatment is sphincterotomy and stenting for a while. More people don't have it than do, because it's not unusual to get a referral for right upper quadrant pain, and the referring doctor says, "I think this patient has sphincter of Oddi dysfunction, because I can't find anything else." The only way to diagnose it conclusively is with biliary manometry, and about 15 to 20% of all people who you do biliary manometry on get pancreatitis. So nobody's very excited about doing manometry until we come up with a better way to do it. So it's a difficult diagnosis. Drugs that cause pancreatitis, you can see common, uncommon, and rare. I think as a gastroenterologist, the one that I see the most is probably azathioprine there on the far left. Don't recall that I have seen any of these other drugs cause pancreatitis, but they're certainly reported to have done that. Pancreatic enzymes, amylase and lipase, can be elevated for a variety of reasons. If you have an amylase and lipase in the 600, 700, 800s or thousands or higher, that there's not much doubt that you're dealing with acute pancreatitis. But what about an amylase that's 200 with a normal lipase? You can see a list of things here that may cause amylase and lipase to be elevated. So you could be asked a question on an exam about an individual who has belly pain and has an elevated amylase. But all the studies of the pancreas, the ultrasound, the CT, ERCP or MRCP, depending on what was done, all are normal. So what's going on? What's the problem? Well, keep these other things in mind. Peritonitis, biliary stones, that's going to show up on most people's workups, I think. Intestinal injury, tubo-ovarian disease, renal failure, and macroamylasemia. You have to order macroamylasemia, at least you do in my hospital, if you want them to do it. It's not done routinely. It's a molecule that looks very much like amylase, and on the spectrophotometer looks exactly like amylase, but it's not. It has nothing to do with a diseased pancreas. It's just an abnormal molecule that you don't have to do anything about. But keep these other potential diagnoses in mind. Another problem that you could see a question about is the individual who comes in with mid-epigastric pain. Let's say they're a drinker. They drink a lot of alcohol every day and presented with about 4 days worth of abdominal pain. They haven't had a drink since the pain started, so labs drawn. And if the patient comes into the emergency room, let's say right about here after 4 or 5 days, what's the only thing that's going to be elevated? The lipase, right? So you may be asked to explain how a patient could have an elevated lipase with a normal amylase. And the reason is because the lipase is cleared slower renally than the amylase is. Important concept to keep in mind. This is a cartoon that you can tell is a normal CT scan of the upper abdomen on the left. On the right is what happens when the inflammation occurs in the pancreas. And since there's no serosa around the pancreas, the inflammation can go literally anywhere. You can have pancreatic encephalopathy. You can have lesions on the skin and on the lower extremities because of the effects of the inflamed pancreas working its way through the fascial planes into even the extremities of the body. This, it can go anywhere. It usually stays mostly in the abdomen, maybe occasionally up into the chest. But this, as this diagram shows, because there isn't a serosa around the pancreas, it can literally go anywhere. You may have a patient develop ascites if it all stays in the abdomen. They develop a lot of fluid in the abdomen. During the first few hours, in the case of acute pancreatitis, you have a list of potential things here that you should watch for as to whether the patient's improving or not. If they develop an encephalopathy, if they become hypoxic, if they become tachycardic, hypotensive, hematocrit goes up, they become oliguric or have azotemia, those are bad signs. Now you'll notice that with the exception of the first two there, encephalopathy and hypoxemia, all the rest of those are related to hydration. And when somebody has acute pancreatitis, their pancreas is basically on fire and they're chewing up fluid about as fast as they can. It either gets third spaced or they vomit it or they have diarrhea and get rid of it. So they're most of the time gonna be dry. And when you see these things, tachycardia, hypotension, high hematocrit, oliguria, those type of things, you know that the patient needs fluid. They need IV fluid more than they need anything else. These are physical exam signs that tend to show up on boards. Periumbilical ecchymoses on the left is called Cullen's sign, and ecchymoses on the flank is called Gray-Turner's sign. And all this is those products of inflammation working their way through the fascial planes in the wall of the abdomen, in the one case around the umbilicus, in the other case on the flank. Those are not pathognomonic for acute pancreatitis. They can happen with a lot of different inflammatory conditions that are going on, but you see them associated in the books all the time with acute pancreatitis. So if you see a picture like this on an exam in a patient that has abdominal pain, think about acute pancreatitis. Another view of Gray Turner's. Ranson's criteria. Almost nobody uses this. Ranson was a surgeon. It was designed to be able to try and prognosticate what's going to happen in a patient with acute pancreatitis. And these are the criteria. I show them to you strictly because they still show up on the boards from time to time. So you need to know what it's all about. You check these things at admission and then in 48 hours, and you supposedly can kind of get a handle on how this patient's going to do. Well, any of you that take care of people with acute pancreatitis know that just by looking at the patient, you can pretty much tell what's going to happen. You don't necessarily have to have these particular numbers. If they're worse on a day-by-day basis, then their prognosis is not good. If they're getting better every day, then they're going to do pretty well, most likely. But you still have to understand these because there may be a question about Ranson's criteria on the exam, and you need to know these numbers to know exactly how to answer it. I think there's some other scales that are in use now, the Glasgow, the Apache, and then the numbers on those, there's several different iterations of those that are used more often than Ranson's. But it is true that the more Ranson's criteria that are positive, the worse the prognosis of the patient is going to be. So what's treatment for acute pancreatitis? Well, if you had graduated from medical school in 1970 and were in this class, you would notice that not much has changed in the treatment of acute pancreatitis over the last 60 years. Pain control and IV fluids are still where most of the action is. There's been a multitude of things tried. People have tried nasogastric suction. They have tried IV cimetidine. They have tried, there were two surgeons by the name of Paxton and Payne back in the 40s that took all these patients with acute pancreatitis into the OR, cleaned out all the inflammatory products in the abdomen, and all the patients died. So that was not a very good solution. We're still stuck with medical therapy. Antibiotics routinely are not helpful. We have to treat whatever comes up. And right now, the only thing we know of proven value is IV fluids and pain control. There's always a lot of discussion on the GI team about Demerol versus morphine, one of them causing spasm of the sphincter of Oddi. I think that's more in the textbook than it is in the real world. Use whatever seems to give the patient the most relief. And that's important to give pain relief, because if you don't, the tachycardia may not correct, the sweating may not correct. Give whatever's necessary to give that patient pain relief. It's critical along with IV fluids. And at that point, then you keep an eye on them. You just watch. You look for infection. If there's some suspicion that they may have common duct stones, you may have to intervene if the pancreatitis doesn't relent. Do an ERCP and clear out that common duct, but that's about the only time that you would do an ERCP when somebody is acutely ill with acute pancreatitis. And most of those other things on there do have some place. Yeah, there's times when somebody's throwing up all the time, they need a nasogastric tube. I think of all the things we do to people in the hospital, they hate nasogastric tubes the most, but sometimes it helps if they're throwing up all the time. This is kind of a busy slide. I apologize for that. I guess what I want you to remember is right there at the top, resuscitation. Just as if they were a GI bleeder. Give GI bleeders all the fluids they can handle. Give acute pancreatitis patients all the fluids they can handle as well. The other things that are on there are dependent upon what happens during the illness. Do they develop necrosis? Do they have a mild case and get better within a couple of days and go home? That this is an algorithm for that, but won't spend any more time on it than that. Nutritional support. Keep this in mind, you usually don't need it unless they're going to be without food or intake for 5 to 7 days. If it looks at day 5 like they're not going to be able to eat for a while, then consider placing a nasoduodenal tube. You don't have to do parenteral nutrition. You can use the gut, which you should, for several different reasons. If there's some reason you can't, then parenteral nutrition is better than nothing. But they should start to come around in 5 to 7 days and be able to start taking in food and fluid again in most circumstances, unless they're very ill. Major complications, we usually divide these into early versus late, or local versus systemic and metabolic. You can see what we're talking about there on the local ones as well as systemic and metabolic. Probably the ones we fear the most are the systemic ones, because that means that it's not just their pancreas is sick, their whole body is sick. And if they get a systemic problem with the respiratory system, they start having hypoxia, they don't breathe as well, and they're in danger of a systemic inflammatory response and getting worse instead of better. Early on, systemic inflammatory response syndrome, what I just mentioned, claims a lot of lives, as does multi-organ failure. Late, causes of mortality, again, multi-organ failure and pancreatic infection and sepsis. Those are very bad news. They're treatable, but usually you've got such a sick patient that they have trouble recovering, even with adequate treatment. This is a progression to a pseudocyst. Now, you can get a CT scan anytime you think you need one. If you aren't sure what the cause of the pancreatitis is, you may do that off the bat. But you probably won't be able to tell if there's an area of necrosis unless you wait until about day 3. Now, what you're seeing here is a couple of different things. This is the pancreas here, and this is the pancreas over here. This was an early CT scan that did show a little bit of necrosis here, the dark area. When pancreas dies, it doesn't get blood flow anymore. And so you end up with dark areas like this. A few weeks later, though, the patient developed a pseudocyst. A pseudocyst may be benign. You have to watch them and see how big they get. They may have to be drained by radiology if they get too big. If they're less than about 6 centimeters, you can just keep an eye on them. You don't have to do anything unless the patient's having a lot of pain or something like that. This is a patient with a large pseudocyst that had a needle put into it, and you can see the needle over here, the radiologist needle right there. Usually the radiologist drains it, and that sometimes that's all that needs to be done, but sometimes they have to have surgery to keep that pseudocyst from filling up again. You just have to watch them and see what happens. These are the complications of a pseudocyst. They occur usually, it's a late complication most of the time. They occur usually 6 weeks out from the original episode of pancreatitis. These are the things that can go wrong, and it has to be addressed, obviously, in these circumstances. What you've got here is an abscess. Again, usually a late complication. You see gas bubbles in there, so there's some kind of gas-forming organism. Here's the radiologist's needle again. The radiologist has aspirated a lot of the pus and the infection. Patient still needs IV antibiotics, and they still need to go to surgery to have that all cleaned up. On the left, you see a normal pancreas, or probably day 1 of the acute pancreatitis. On the right, day 3. That's what I was talking about a while ago. On day 1, you can't tell what's going to happen. Are they going to get necrosis? Or are they going to do fine? Well, you don't know for sure. On day 3, you should be able to determine that. And that what you're seeing there is pancreatic necrosis. What matters now at this point is the necrosis sterile or is it infected? Now, if the patient doesn't feel bad, they're not running fevers, and they don't have a high white count, and they're not doing too bad, you can keep an eye on them. But if they start having a white count, fever, belly pain, then you need to aspirate some of that area that's necrotic and see what's growing there and treat accordingly, and may require surgery again. Debridement versus observation. Hopefully you can just observe, because surgery's tough on people that are that ill. Signs of an infected pancreatic necrosis, just mentioned all of that. On the bottom slide there on the right, in the right-hand corner, you see the infectious organism that is causing the patient to have an abscess. You can treat accordingly once you get that Gram stain, and then the bacteriology lab will grow it and see what turns up. treatment strategies for sterile necrosis, medical therapy, and that doesn't mean antibiotics at this point. Nobody recommends prophylactic antibiotics if you have sterile necrosis. Too many potential problems with the antibiotics. Infection is a whole different story. You need antibiotics and you need needle drainage and probably debridement in surgery. Chronic pancreatitis, alcohol, biggest player there. There's a group that's idiopathic. Other causes you can see on the right there that occur occasionally. Patients typically have pain, calcifications on the x-ray. I've got an ultrasound and I think maybe a CT and a plain film that show calcification. And pancreatic insufficiency. In other words, they don't produce pancreatic enzymes, so you have to replace them with a variety of different brands that we have available to us. So chronic pancreatitis can generally be diagnosed clinically. You know the history, you know they've had acute pancreatitis, you know that whatever the cause is, if they were drinkers, that they probably have chronic pancreatitis because of that, or they've had several episodes of biliary pancreatitis, whatever the case may be. There are some tests here that you should know about that examine either the structure or the function of the pancreas. Now, we don't do these functional tests anymore. They're still here on the review course because they still may show up on the boards. What you should know, though, are the structural tests, the ERCP, the CT, ultrasound, and that can be either a plain ultrasound or an endoscopic ultrasound. Plain films still have some value, and the one that's not up here that should be is MRCP or MRI of the pancreas. So what you want to try to do is address the two biggest problems with chronic pancreatitis, pain and the malabsorption that they may have with their chronic pancreatitis. And they have to stop drinking, or we have to try and get rid of the gallstones, bring their triglycerides down, whatever needs to be done. And this is difficult because you know what happens when you adequately treat somebody's pain. You oftentimes have to do it with narcotics, and that's a difficult wire to walk. So I usually get the pain team involved, have somebody that's an expert in managing the pain medicines to see them and help me with that. And malabsorption is, again, treated with enzymes, and have them see the dietitian for a low-fat diet. Fat is more difficult to digest than carbohydrates or protein. And the dietitian can usually give them a diet that helps them to not have diarrhea along with the medicine that you prescribed. Secretin test, this is just how it works. It's another one of those things that's not very pleasant for the patient. They put a nasogastric tube down and stimulate the pancreas with IV secretin and measure how much water and how much bicarb are excreted by the pancreas. Again, we don't have to do it. It doesn't serve any purpose anymore, but you might see it on the examination. This is a pancreatogram done at the time of an ERCP. Now, if you don't do these fairly often, this may not look like any big deal to you, but this is a diseased and abnormal pancreatogram. The duct is dilated. All of the side ducts are abnormal. They're ratty looking. They've got narrow areas and thick areas. This is classic for a patient with chronic pancreatitis. This is an ultrasound, and what you're seeing here are calcifications. I still think there's a certain amount of voodoo with ultrasound, but they seem to know what they're talking about. These are calcifications in the head of the pancreas, and that is chronic pancreatitis until you can prove otherwise. I've had a patient or two that came in with calcifications in the pancreas during my career that I couldn't prove they had chronic pancreatitis. So I'm not convinced that there may be another cause for calcifications, but most gastroenterologists will tell you that calcifications equal chronic pancreatitis, and usually it does. But I haven't experienced that to be 100%. Here's a CT scan, and you notice a dilated duct and calcifications again in the head. Dilated duct, calcifications. Again, this is most likely secondary to chronic pancreatitis. Plain film of the abdomen and some calcifications here, as you can see right there. A another complication of chronic pancreatitis. This is every gastroenterologist's nightmare. You called in at 2 a.m. because a patient just threw up blood. They need an upper endoscopy. You put the scope down. Esophagus looks good. You look at the stomach. You don't see too much, and you're thinking, this is going to be a short case. I can go home and go back to bed. You retroflex the scope, looking up at the cardia of the stomach, and you see this. These are gastric varices. Now, there's, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when I gave this talk, I would have told you that this is very bad news because there's not much you can do for this besides a TIPS catheter. There are some treatments now. Somebody at the a couple of the advanced endoscopists at the university are doing injection of they call it a glue. I don't think it's strictly a glue, but anyway, there are some treatments for gastric varices now, but it was a case that if they bled, you and the patient were both just kind of out of luck. It was difficult to do anything with these. But what's going on here in the case of chronic pancreatitis, this is not liver disease like we usually see it. This is a splenic vein thrombosis caused from the splenic vein laying right next to an inflamed pancreas. This is what you don't want to see. Okay, cystic neoplasms. There's a whole list of these cystic neoplasms. Some of them have malignant potential, some of them don't. The cystic neoplasm is one of the benign ones. You can see it right here. And these occur in a patient that's never had pancreatitis. Some of them are discovered incidentally, some of them are discovered because the patient's having pain. You ordinarily will get a fluid analysis and try to determine whether there is any cause for further investigation, like malignant cells, that type of thing. But most of these, unless they're causing pain, usually nothing is done to treat them. They can be needled and drained, but you don't have to do that if they're asymptomatic. Pseudocyst is a different animal than a cystic neoplasm. They look different. They occur in a different setting. Serous cystadenomas, mucinous cystadenomas, mucinous cystadenocarcinomas are all various types of cystic neoplasms. They have different malignant potential, as you can see on the slide there. And by and large, they are problems that the radiologist will pick up either investigating a symptom or in a patient that had a CT scan done for some other reason, and one of these just turned up because it was small. I don't know how this should have occurred. This slide should have occurred back when we were talking about pancreatitis, but it's, I already talked about it to some degree. Nutritional management just means to modify the fat intake. Vitamins and supplements, if necessary. I'm not a big vitamin person. I don't prescribe vitamins a lot unless there's a good reason to do it. It kind of is a function of your patient's nutritional status. If their weight is normal, they're able to eat enough to keep their weight up and to keep their nutrition up, you probably don't need vitamins and that type of thing. But if they're very sick with it and they need medium chain triglycerides and they need extremely low fat diet, then these other things you see down here at the bottom may be things that are worth doing. Pain management. Goes without saying, no alcohol. Some patients, and you'd be surprised, I continually am surprised at a patient who at least says they didn't know beer was alcohol. That may be more common in rural Missouri than it is anywhere else, I don't know. But you do find a patient that at least says that. They feign surprise. They say, gosh, I had no idea. Just like aspirin's not medicine. But they have to lay off the alcohol regardless of what their favorite drink was. Analgesia, I already talked about, enzyme replacement. Neurolytic therapy, if you have a good radiologist or a good gastroenterologist, they can inject the celiac plexus and get some pain relief. Pseudocyst drainage, duct decompression, stone removal, we've talked about all of those, and you can see how effective or ineffective those things are on the other side there. Pancreatic cancer risk is elevated in people with chronic pancreatitis. There's not a lot you can do about it other than follow them with imaging. Try to stay on top of it. Insufficiency without pancreatitis. There are a list of things that may cause that. These would probably be good to review prior to the examination. I can't even spell Swatchman there without looking at it, much less ever had a case of it, so I can't tell you what that is, but these are some of the things that, especially on the left there, are things you should probably know about. Autoimmune pancreatitis looks like a tumor. The imaging study that you get on a patient initially, it looks like, you look at it and you think, well, this patient's got adenocarcinoma of the pancreas, but in fact, they don't. They have autoimmune pancreatitis, and it's an immune process. I don't know that we've only known about this for a few years, so I don't know that there's much knowledge out there about why people get it and what causes it, but it presents with pain. Occasionally, they'll have acute pancreatitis or obstructive jaundice, or an incidental pancreatic mass, and so you're still thinking adenocarcinoma at this point. In order to distinguish the two, you just about have to have a biopsy, or the other thing you can do is do a trial of steroids. Autoimmune pancreatitis almost always responds very well to prednisone or some type of steroid, and you get your answer there.